Hey, my name is Amy and I work at Lowe's. Summer's not over yet and grilling season is still going strong. Luckily, Lowe's has low prices on items across the store. Right now, stop by and get a Grillmaster 3-burner gas grill for just $169 or a Master Forge 2-burner patio grill for only $199. Then cool things off with a 50-foot never kink water hose, now just $26.98. Find these and more everyday low prices right now at Lowe's. Lowe's, let's build something together. Some restrictions apply. See store for details.
Blog Talk.
Well, welcome. Today is Monday, not our usual Tuesday, and this is Rottweilers Then and Now, and the only talk show that is all about Rottweilers. I'm so glad that you have stopped by, and we have a lot of listeners out there, and welcome to you folks that are on chat. Before we get to the program, and it's going to be a real tight one, we have a lot of information we're going to try to cram in. A lot of questions have been sent in that we hope to get answered. I want to let you know that last week I started a little contest and no one has called in with the answer. You must call in during a show time or type it on the chat. And the question is, what was the name of and the owner of the first Rottweiler to receive an AKC CD and AKC championship? So what was the name of the first Rottweiler in the U.S. that received an AKC championship and CD, and who was the owner? And I'm cheap, as everyone knows, but I'll send out a little gift card that you can use to buy a favorite toy for your favorite Rottweiler. With that said, I am very excited about today's show, and I want to get right to it. Those of you listening have already know that today our special guest, and I say that plurally, is Dr. Catherine, or Kate, Muirs, who is the actual leading research scientist in studying SAS in Rottweilers. And she is accompanied by a colleague, and we're so excited to have him as well, Dr. Josh Stern, who is a resident cardiologist at the North Carolina University College of Veterinary Medicine. So with that, I want to jump right into it. Both of you, Dr. Muirs, if possible you will lead off, and a little bit about yourself, what led you into research, and specifically Rottweilers, and how long have you been active in canine research, and what would be your ultimate goal that you hope to uncover during your research?
All right. Can you hear me all right, Jan?
I can hear you fine, and I've indicated those that are on the chat line because you are on speaker. I will not be able to detect a problem because I have the direct line, but they may, and if they do, they're supposed to let me know immediately.
All right, Jan. Well, thank you for organizing this evening. Let's see, a little bit about myself. I went to veterinary school at University of Wisconsin and then came here to North Carolina State to do a small animal internship and then did a cardiology residency at Texas A&M and a PhD in genetics there. And then I worked at Ohio State for 7 years and then Washington State University for a few years, and now I'm back here at North Carolina to stay. So that's a little bit about me. Most of my research is in genetics of heart disease in dogs and cats, and I became interested in genetics because as a cardiologist, we diagnosed a lot of heart disease in pure breed dogs and cats, but we didn't really understand what caused it. And when you see things existing in a single breed, you start to think that it might be inherited. And I started reading on genetics, and I found it very interesting and could understand that, or could see that some heart diseases in dogs and cats were pretty well documented as being inherited. So that really fueled my interest in genetics to try to find what causes a disease so we can gradually over time reduce the prevalence of its existence. Why Great. Rottweilers? Well, actually my My parents have owned Rottweilers for years. My father's from Holland, and they were a very popular dog there. And so he actually has two Rottweilers now. They have had probably a maximum of two at any time. He gets them from the Rottweiler Rescue and really loves the breed. And I think beyond that, I sort of got interested just in that aortic stenosis was a very bad congenital heart disease. And some dogs, fortunately, live very comfortably with it. But if they have what we call moderate or severe aortic stenosis, we believe they have an average lifespan of about 2 years, which is pretty devastating. And so I think it's an important project for us to work on.
Sure, absolutely. And kudos to your father for rescuing Rottweilers. And do you have a current dog right now? And if so, what is it and a name?
I actually have two dogs, and they are Pomeranians. I know, it seems a little bit different compared to growing up with Rottweilers, but I've had Pomeranians now since, I guess, 1991, because one was donated here, actually, when I was an intern here, and it had a heart defect, very similar to what Rottweilers get, although it's on the other side of the heart, called a pulmonic stenosis instead of aortic stenosis. And I found that Pomeranians fit pretty well with my current lifestyle, which is that I spend a fair amount of time at work. And so I don't have a lot of time for a dog that needs to go for a run or needs a big yard. Pomeranians, pretty much you can carry them in and out and move them over if they're sitting on your part of the sofa. So they work pretty well. And they get a lot of heart disease, too. So that fits other parts that I like. So I have two Pomeranians. And I've pretty much had at least two Pomeranians for the past, I don't know, I guess 20 years now. Amazing and a little embarrassing.
No, they're absolutely delightful animals. I've actually rescued a couple in the past years.
Good.
With that, Dr. Stern, can you kind of tell us a little about yourself? And so we're delighted to have you.
Sure, thank you. So I'm originally from Ohio and spent my time there doing veterinary school and my internship at Ohio State University, at which point I met Dr. Muirs and got involved in some of the genetics research that she was doing at the time. And after that, I went on to do the first part of my cardiology residency there at WSU or Washington State. And then we moved on to North Carolina State University, where I am now, finishing up my residency. And also my PhD in genetics. How I got interested in genetics and aortic stenosis research actually came about because of my original breed interest, which was Golden Retrievers. I used to work for a breeder and kennel that showed and raised Golden Retrievers and became familiar with some of the devastating things that could happen with dogs that had subvalvular aortic stenosis. So that became my area of interest for research, and it fitted nicely to the genetics research that Dr. Muirs was already doing. From there, we kind of expanded to do Rottweilers because they share that heart disease, and I got to know some folks in the Rottweiler breed groups and clubs, which was really helpful and great for the research. I have a Golden Retriever myself right now that I've had for the past 6 years, named Florin, and she keeps me pretty busy after work.
I can bet, and it's always wonderful to have any dog, small or large, to be at that door to welcome you home after a busy day at work. So with that, I'm just so excited to have you both here, and let's jump right into it. I did send you a very confusing outline because, and I had hoped to be able to acknowledge all of those that submitted their questions, but since a multitude of questions came in, I tried to regroup them so there'd be some sort of semblance of order. So with that, you know who you are. You will hear your questions come up, and thank you for the support of the program. So with that, why don't we start out, if you can give either one of you a brief explanation of exactly what is SAS, and also mention, I've heard the phrase, acquired SAS, so that there's a little foundation of what the disease is like. And I hope everyone out there listening has downloaded the PowerPoint presentation that was just sent to me by both of our guests. So if you can download that and just have it ready, they will let you know when to open that and use as some points. So go ahead, either one of you. SAS, and what is acquired SAS?
Okay, so I can give a little bit of a background about SAS and what it means from a cardiology perspective. So SAS stands for subvalvular aortic stenosis, and that is a problem within the left ventricle on the way out the aorta. So the subvalvular part stands for the fact that this defect happens just below the level of the aortic valve. And the stenosis part means that there's a narrowing at that level. So what happens is dogs have this narrowing that kind of partially occludes outflow from their left ventricle and increases the pressure as they try to pump blood out of that chamber in their heart. That kind of increases the workload on the heart and can secondarily make your heart muscle thick, cause some problems as it goes by your valve quickly, and cause those valves to leak a little bit, and ultimately lead to things like arrhythmias or sudden death even, as well as problems such as congestive heart failure. So it's really a primary disease that occurs below the valve, but the problems that happen because of it extend into the ventricle and then can lead to both electrical or structural problems in the dog.
And what is the term acquired SAS? Is this something, an anomaly or a factor that develops later in age and is also genetically influenced?
Cardiologists don't really use that term, so I'm not sure what exactly that means. I mean, acquired in the veterinary cardiology world usually means a trait that shows up once they're an adult, like cardiomyopathy or valve disease in a small breed dog. It's a bad term to use, actually, because those diseases are usually inherited, but they just don't show up until the dog is an adult. And whereas acquired sort of means they all of a sudden just got this trait. And because we generally think of subvalvular aortic stenosis as a birth defect that is present since birth but gets a little bit worse over the first year of age, I don't know. I have not heard veterinary cardiologists refer to it as acquired aortic stenosis. It is possible. Every once in a while, a dog gets an infection on the heart valve, and a big infection can cause blockage of blood flow going out the heart, or even a tumor could do it. But then we might say, you know, the infected valve is causing obstruction of the valve, but we wouldn't generally call that acquired aortic stenosis. So I'm not sure exactly how they were using that terminology.
Okay, good. I'm glad you clarified that. So basically, they're possibly using the terminology because maybe the dog has had an examination at earlier age, but then later in life, all of a sudden, a type of murmur has developed, and which sets due to some medical condition other than a genetic condition other than a heritable condition. So that's probably where that has developed. Thank you for clarifying that. We've been asked, will SAS, does it skip generations? Can SAS be in a certain dog and not show up again until later generations, as far as you know?
Yeah, I think we've been doing a lot of research looking at pedigrees and dogs that we have evaluated ourselves and called either clearly affected or clearly normal. And amongst those groups, we've also seen dogs that we consider in the gray zone, or what we would consider an equivocal category for having aortic stenosis. I think that lends us to the notion that it's certainly possible that there are dogs out there that can have mild forms of this heart disease and go completely unrecognized for a long, long time. It brings up the genetics point that Just because you have a mutation doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to show that disease or that you're going to show that disease to the same extent as another dog that has the same mutation. It's a concept that we call penetrance. So you could have a mutation that leads to aortic stenosis, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a severe variety that would get picked up. I think that's one really reasonable explanation for why we could see dogs that are clear or relatively free of disease produce puppies that are affected. That kind of lends to how this disease might be inherited.
Very, very interesting. And we'll probably touch on that a little bit later as we go down our list of questions, I'm sure. The next one we tried to line up is do you anticipate a DNA test, a way to test for this in the near future? And is that obviously one of your goals?
Well, I'll give Dr. Stern a brief break for a second. I would say that that's certainly something he's working on all the time, and that would be, that is the goal, not to have, I mean, I think it's important to think about those DNA tests as not a absolute marker for this line of dogs can't be used for breeding and this line can, because sometimes what we find is that there's so many dogs that have the genetic trait that you would really hurt the breed if you removed everybody. So what our goal would be to have a genetic test that can be used to say this dog has the genetic mutation, and then working with the breed organization, folks can make educated decisions about their line, how to gradually over time reduce the prevalence of that trait. So that is the goal, to have a genetic test that you can use as a tool to make the best decisions about your breed. How long that would take is really hard to know. You know, we've done this type of thing for a while, and sometimes, unfortunately, it can take 10 years or longer. I mean, if you look at the human genetic world, you know, things like what is the genetic defect that causes some types of cancer, they just don't know, and they have a lot more time and resources and money than we do. So these things can take years. And on the other hand, sometimes you can be fortunate and hard work can find something within a year. But I think what's really important is that folks realize it could be several years, because if they don't think about that from the start, then they lose enthusiasm for a project. You know, they donate samples, they may donate a little bit of money to the research, but if they don't have an answer in 1 to 2 years, they'll feel like they've wasted their time and effort. But it can take 10 years or so, and that's not even a guarantee that it will absolutely be able to figure it out. These things can be very complicated.
Sure, and understandably so. So that actually would lead to the following question. In other words, if SAS is in within a given line, or parents have produced an SAS, siblings from that litter that are clear, don't avoid breeding a group of dogs just based on the findings that there has been SAS, because it's pretty widespread in the breed. Would that be a correct statement?
I think that's right. And as Dr. Stern said initially, it does appear to sometimes skip a generation, which makes you think that it could possibly be recessive. So you can use that information already by carefully outbreeding. So if something is recessive, you may have members that are being silent carriers, as he mentioned. So often, if they're within the same line or too closely related, you have a higher risk of accidentally breeding two silent carriers to each other and suddenly having puppies that show the trait. So what we would say is if you already know you've seen a problem in a line that you are working with, years before there's a genetic test, one way to start would be to start breeding away from that line, not totally discontinuing that line, but breeding outwards to dogs that you're quite sure are at least several generations removed.
Interesting, and I think that's a very, very good point for breeders, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people are looking forward to the show of learning, that type of information. It gives them a direction and a way to go, because there is an awful lot of hearsay and rumor and gossip, and everybody has their opinions, and that's why we have you on. all right, and during your research, before we get into diagnostics and more information for breeders, in the research that you have done to date, have you found any surprises that you had not anticipated, be they positive or negative?
Yeah, I think we've had some interesting findings come about as we've been looking at multiple breeds that have sub-aortic stenosis. I think one of those interesting findings for us was that two breeds that we've studied rather heavily for SAS have a similar genetic pattern when we've looked at dogs that have this trait. So both the Rottweilers and the Golden Retrievers share a chromosomal region of high interest as a region to look at for maybe having a causative mutation. Going along with that, another point of interest that came up was that this was in contrast to the Newfoundland dogs that we looked at. Dogs that have the same disease had a very different genetic profile when we looked at regions of interest. So I think there are some definite intriguing findings coming out of that, thinking that some breeds may share a genetic mutation while there are others that could be completely different. Looking at a lot of Rottweilers at the last national specialty that we went to, we saw that the pattern of this disease in Rottweilers was a little different than many of the other sporting breeds that we had looked at with SAS. Rottweilers seemed to have slightly different appearance on echocardiogram than other breeds, and that was a bit of interest to us as well.
Interesting. With that kind of leads into the testing, diagnostics. What is basically the youngest age that you recommend for a breeder to bring in Rottweiler puppies, or an owner for that matter? And what is the preferred method of testing in young dogs to rule out right away if there is a problem? And how effective is that test?
Well, I'll start tackling part of the question, which is, when should you start evaluating dogs for congenital heart disease, whether it be SAS or any other disease? And I think that breeders do a really good job, at least most of the breeders that we've seen participate in the study and those which have come through the clinic, of having their puppies listened to at their routine health evaluations, both at the time of vaccinations and so on. So really, they can never be too young to listen to them for the presence of heart murmurs and obvious changes to their auscultation or listening to their heart. That doesn't mean that at that age we're definitely going to be able to pick up a murmur that goes along with subvalvular aortic stenosis or be sure of what we're hearing. Lots of puppies can have innocent murmurs that do go away, but I think the first step in screening your dog does happen when they're pups, being listened to by your family veterinarian and identifying which ones are at risk for having more serious heart disease. I think that's certainly the first step. From a screening standpoint,
No, I was just going to say, given that information, what would you recommend the youngest age to take a puppy in?
Oh, I mean, I think unless they're feeling otherwise ill, you can do it in accordance with your regular scheduled evaluations for your pups. You know, if you do your first set of vaccines at 6 or 8 weeks, I think that's a fine time to have those puppies listened to by your family vet.
Great. Okay. And any obvious problems, they should be able to pick it up under auscultation at that early age if there is something really serious there.
I think when we see severe SAS, those dogs have reported murmurs from the time they were quite young. And certainly by the time they get their first rabies vaccination and go to their new homes, people have picked up on the murmurs of dogs that have severe heart disease.
Okay, can you explain for the novice listener the difference between an auscultation and, let's say, an echocardiogram and then an echo with Doppler and the importance of each, if there is one that is of greater preference?
Sure. So let's go back to the screening of your dog's question for just a brief moment and say that after that first auscultation visit or listening to the dog's heart with your stethoscope, the next step for most breeders is to go ahead and get their cardiac certification or OFA clearance. And different breed clubs have different recommendations for when that is done, but at least from a certification standpoint, the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals that provides us with cardiac clearance forms says that they have to be at least 12 months of age, and then we can certify them as the presence or absence of a heart murmur, plus or minus findings by echocardiography or ultrasound of the heart. The difference between those tests being auscultation only is just a cardiologist or your family veterinarian using a stethoscope to listen to the heart. And we do that to listen to the normal heart sounds and listen for changes in flow patterns and the presence of heart murmurs. Subvalvular aortic stenosis is a disease that generates a pretty nice heart murmur that can be heard often quite loudly at the heart base. So auscultation seems to be a pretty sensitive tool for screening dogs for subvalvular aortic stenosis. The next step in testing, however, once you identify a heart murmur, is finding out why it's there. And unfortunately, subvalvular aortic stenosis isn't the only heart disease that we have to deal with that generates a murmur at that location. So the way that we do that is by investigating how things look inside the heart and looking for a reason for that heart murmur that we heard. That's done with an ultrasound of the heart called an echocardiogram. And that ultrasound provides us with structural details of the heart, how the valves look, how big the chambers are, how well they contract. And then there's some manipulations that we can perform with echocardiography to decide not only how things look, but how fast blood moves. Because we know dogs that have subvalvular aortic stenosis have an increased velocity or speed of blood flow leaving their ventricle and entering their aorta. And that's become kind of the diagnostic criteria of choice, is to measure the speed at which that blood moves. And that would be called Doppler echocardiography. So we use an equation to determine how fast blood is moving across that valve. And we know what speed normal dogs move blood across the valve. And we know clearly affected dogs move at a higher velocity, and we use that as a diagnostic criteria for screening dogs for SAS and reporting that out on your OFA forms for your cardiac clearances.
Interesting. I have kind of a side question that comes up. Do you and at what age would you recommend Let me back up here. What is the best diagnostic tool that a breeder should consider, say, prior to breeding their dog? And older dogs, is it necessary to do it again? And should the tests be done preferably by a practitioner, a practicing veterinarian, or a cardiologist?
Okay. I think from a screening standpoint, OFA says that those dogs should be about a year old, and I know that some breed clubs have extended that out to be a little older. I think the point of making it so that we're certifying these dogs at that age is so that we don't have to feel like we need to repeat this screening test, at least for subvalvular aortic stenosis. By the time those dogs reach skeletal maturity and we take a listen to them and look at them with an echocardiogram, we can be pretty certain whether they have or don't have subvalvular aortic stenosis. That is not the same for diseases that affect cats and some of the cardiomyopathies that affect other breeds. But in SAS, it is a lesion that they're born with, and as they grow, we can see the severity of that lesion increase or get a little worse. But usually by the time they reach skeletal maturity, we're good to screen them once for this lesion and call them clear or affected. The reevaluation screenings come in when we identify a dog that lies somewhere in the middle, not clearly normal and not clearly affected. Those are dogs that we might say, if this dog means a lot to your breeding program and you're not willing to exclude them from your breeding program right now, perhaps we should reevaluate them in 6 or 12 months and see what those numbers settle out to be again. And use that as a way to hopefully decide what that gray zone means for that dog.
great, good information. Thank you again. Furthering on that, the American Rottweiler Club, which is the parent club for the breed recognized by AKC, they require the cardiac testing being done at no less than 2 years old. And that's along with the hips and the elbows and the other tests that are done prior to breeding. Should a breeder have a preference, or should a breeder accept auscultation? We're talking now of a 2-year-old, a young adult. Would auscultation be adequate, or should they go ahead and opt to have an echocardiogram at the very least done? And the reason I'm asking is that during one of the nationals of just a few years back, a cardiologist was present, and of the dogs that had been auscultated at an earlier time, they did echocardiogram and they did discover murmurs, and it really raised quite a stir that, oh my gosh, what do we do now? We thought our dogs were clear. Now, because of the clinic that was at the National, we took advantage of it, and we have received a diagnosis of murmurs. Can you kind of maybe help enlighten, what are your feelings on this?
I think it's going to depend a little bit on cost. Sort of, it's sort of a risk benefit type thing, and really the gold standard that is non-invasive, meaning you can do it without being anesthetized, is for a dog to have an echocardiogram done with Doppler, I believe, by a cardiologist, because there are other people out there that can buy an ultrasound and perform ultrasound, like radiologists and even general practitioners. But as you guys are learning from this experience and from other experience other people may have had, not everyone performs the cardiac echocardiogram and Doppler the same way. And aortic stenosis is actually a pretty tricky a defect, particularly when you're looking at mild and equivocal ones. Most people with minimal training can diagnose severe, but when you're trying to pick up mild or equivocal, you're trying to make breeding decisions on that is harder. And so I think it needs to be done by a cardiologist who has adequate training. So if you really want to know, have the best shot to know the most information, I think you see a cardiologist and you have an echo done with Doppler. However, depending on where you live, that may be $500. And
sure,
for many folks, that's too expensive, particularly right now. And so I think that a less expensive way is auscultation. And if, again, by a boarded cardiologist, by somebody with training, and if they hear a murmur when they listen with a stethoscope, then that dog definitely needs an echo. If they don't hear a murmur, that doesn't mean that 100% of the time they don't have aortic stenosis. But I think particularly if they are an adult dog, so over a year of age, and they don't have a murmur there and it was listened to by trained ears, I think the likelihood that they have sort of silent aortic stenosis is very low. So I think the reality is that some people will need to make a risk-benefit decision based on their finances right now. And the best way to do it is to go the expensive way and have a boarded cardiologist do it with the right equipment. If you can't afford that, I think, again, having a cardiologist listen to the dog when it's an adult is a reasonable approach, understanding that you may miss, I think, a small percentage. I don't think you're going to miss a large number of dogs if you have an expert doing the evaluation. That's just my opinion. And Dr. Stern and I haven't exchanged answers before we started. I don't know if he feels differently, and I'll let him chime in as well.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I think that if you can get there and have a cardiologist evaluate your dog for this disease, by both auscultation and echo, you run the best chance of identifying dogs that have this defect. And certainly this is a point where breed clubs can get involved and make this an easier test for people to have performed. You know, we have a really good group of cardiologists all around the country, and lots of those folks do cardiology screening clinics, like you mentioned, happened at your national specialty, and will come and bring their echocardiogram and sometimes offer that at a rate that is more affordable and easier to have performed for people. So that's a point where you guys can, as a breed group, make a decision to help get that screening done appropriately and maybe in a more efficient and cost-effective way.
Well, great. We had a question relating to this come in on the chat. We've actually, you've been covering the questions as they have been coming in. This one here, if you, and I think you just answered it, if you have a clear cardiac exam at a national by a cardiologist at around 4 years, is it still better to get the additional echo? And I think you just answered that.
Yeah, I think if they mean it, did the cardiologist listen to my dog and say it doesn't have a heart murmur, do I still need an echo, then I think our previous comments still apply, that if you want to be as sure as possible to make sure that your dog doesn't have a subdobular lesion and that his aortic velocities are normal, the echocardiogram is the way to go. Certainly, you can screen dogs very efficiently by listening to them. But the truth of the matter is many, many, many dogs, especially working and sporting breeds, have a heart murmur. So most of those dogs come up with a murmur, and then you're faced with the now what decision. And really the only way to sort out dogs that have a heart murmur as being a benign or physiologic heart murmur, it doesn't mean anything compared to dogs that have a little bit of subdobular aortic stenosis, is by echocardiogram.
Right, a good point. And I think now's the time to bring up the fact, just because now we have two groups of dogs. We have those used in a breeding program and those that are used for, as you mentioned, working or household companions, service dogs, therapy dogs, et cetera, that are never going to be used in a breeding program. Breeding programs, I think, and the doctors will agree, it's extremely important to get the best cardiac exam that is financially able. For you, no less than 2 years of age. But for the others, if your dog is diagnosed with a murmur, it does not equate death. It's there are many, many dogs that have been diagnosed with SAS that live perfectly normal and happy lives. It's just you don't want to introduce them to the program. It depends upon the degree of the disease. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I think that there are plenty of dogs walking around out there that have heart murmurs that are indistinguishable from subdivular aortic stenosis and have absolutely no concerning cardiac defects. A non-breeding person, if your dog comes up with a heart murmur, I think you're faced with the same problem, which is your dog could have a mild form of disease that might ultimately require medication or intervention. The recommendation to move on to echocardiogram is the same for those folks. Now, if you're not breeding your dog, if you have no intention of breeding your Rottweiler and that dog screens clear by auscultation, do you need to have an echocardiogram? Probably not. But if you do, we'd love to have a genetic sample on that dog for our research.
Yeah, we're going to get to that before we end the program, too, on how the Rottweiler owners and breeders can help in the research for this. So we're going to wrap up and hopefully cover that a lot. Okay, some more specific, well, before we do that, one question came in. Do readings vary from one machine to the other? In other words, if you get a good diagnosis with a cardiologist and one echogram is good, is there any concern that the machines actually, the settings, or that there may be a difference?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that there's always a lot of question about does one cardiologist result equate to another cardiologist results? And that goes back to this is a technical skill that we all learn, and we learn them at slightly different places, and we may perform our echocardiograms in slightly different ways. So it is possible that a doctor other than myself might screen a dog and get a slightly different aortic velocity than I get. Generally speaking, those differences do not take your dog from a normal category into an affected category or vice versa. So the differences we're talking about are real and they are there, but to be honest, your aortic velocity will vary a little bit from moment to moment and day to day. So the dog that gets a little more excited on the echo table might have a slightly higher velocity than the dog that's a little more relaxed. And so lots of factors, including who the echocardiographer is and what kind of environment the test is performed in, may alter that number that we ultimately put down on your sheet. But traditionally, the alterations in that number are not drastic enough to take you from affected to normal or vice versa.
Good. Okay. Now, one more question in line of just laying foundation. So terminology, what is the difference between equivocal and affected? What does that mean?
I'll give Dr. Stern a break for a few minutes, and I'll try my best. So, you know, this is, I won't be able to say it as clearly as he, but there's, cardiologists use a number value for deciding whether an animal is clear, equivocal, or affected. So they measure how fast the blood flow is, and if it's greater than a certain number, they consider that affected. If it's less than a certain number, they consider it unaffected, and there's a gray zone, meaning that we can't all agree on what those animals in the gray zone are. So we're pretty sure most cardiologists are pretty comfortable that a dog that has a heart and aortic blood velocity of 1.4 is very normal, and a dog that has a velocity of 3.0 is very abnormal. But it's the area in between that there's much more argument about. And so where exactly those cutoffs are has shifted over the years. Even in the 15 years, I guess, that I've been a cardiologist, those numbers have changed. We used to say anything above 1.7 was abnormal, and now we will say anything above 2.25 is abnormal. So there's a shifting there in what is normal and what is abnormal. And then there's an area in between where we don't exactly know whether a dog that has that value is normal, but it's just maybe a little bit excited today and has a faster heart rate, or it's really abnormal but has a very mild form of the disease. And so what cardiologists did is they said, I don't know what that means, so we're going to call it equivocal. So equivocal basically means we don't know what that means. This might be a dog that has a mild form of the disease, or this might be a dog that is normal but for some reason is just varied a little bit high today. And right now, that equivocal range is 2.25 to 2.5. No, it's actually
on the slides that are on the web there. It's right now listed by our breed group or by our cardiology group as, I think, 1.9 to 2.4.
Okay.
But it's on the slides there. It's a scale that was determined by all of the cardiologists kind of getting together and deciding what we consider surely normal and surely abnormal.
But I would say that's if you're in Europe or who knows in Asia, those are numbers decided by the American Cardiology Group, and it was contentious. Not everybody agreed exactly on those numbers, and what they use in Europe is likely slightly different. So, you know, unfortunately, this is a tricky disease, and we do our best with the information we have, but equivocal basically means a gray area where the animal has a heart velocity that we don't know exactly what it means.
Where to fit it in the slot.
Right.
And that there was an in-depth question on the questions that I had sent to you that I think you have pretty well answered that, and that was in relationship to the change in the velocities, and some cardiologists use their own or make decisions. I think there's one this person says, I've talked to and dealt with a cardiologist that won't pass a dog with velocities above 1.7 or 1.8 or 1.9. So there, and you just kind of explained, and I would imagine the cardiologist and the reviews. And again, if there is a question, a dog that's equivocal, would it not be advisable to possibly have an echocardiogram with Doppler done again, say, at a later date in a different setting?
I think that's very reasonable. I mean, we know that there are some things that affect that, that can make that velocity higher. For instance, if a young dog is very excited, it was jogging around the waiting room, maybe barking, had a rocky car ride in, it's, you know, maybe it's a 13-month-old dog, so it has a lot of energy, and that having that high level of excitement can make it higher, that number higher, just for this visit. If you looked at him next time and he was the only dog that came in and he was very quiet or he was a little bit older, it might actually be lower. There are many people that believe that a dog that is in heat because she has more blood volume may have a slightly higher number. So, and on the converse of that, a dog that is very dehydrated could possibly have a lower than normal number. So I think that's right. I think if you have a number that surprises you, you never expected it to be equivocal, there's no family history, that it's definitely worth getting either a second opinion on or just reevaluating the dog in another month, maybe bringing it in a very quiet setting. And I think if people understandably find it frustrating, why can't cardiologists agree on this? And I just want to give you a little bit of background on this disease and how these things are figured out. As Dr. Stern said, it's in severe cases, it's actually a fibrous ridge that sticks out in the aortic area and one can see by echocardiogram. In the milder cases, we don't see that ridge very well, so we basically measure these numbers. But then we have these dogs in the equivocal range. So could they possibly have a little ridge there that we can't see, and that's what's making the number higher? The only way we could ever answer that question, what does equivocal really mean? How could veterinary cardiologists answer that question? They would have to do an autopsy on, you know, maybe 200 dogs that had an equivocal range, and they would need to have it done by a pathologist that really was extremely interested in the heart and the aortic valve. That doesn't just mean the Rottweiler group could get together and when these dogs died, send them off to their, you know, their veterinarian and have them send them into a local pathologist. Because you're looking for something pretty mild, you would have to have a lot of dogs when they died and have somebody really carefully look at that heart area and correlate it to the echocardiogram that was done years ago when you were screening them. And that information just does not exist. That's the only way we would really know. And unfortunately, that type of very careful pathologic evaluation of the heart valve area is just not done these days anymore. And to be really honest, there are not experts trained in it anymore. There aren't, as many of you may have experienced, there aren't really very many veterinary pathologists that really, really focus on the heart in that particular area. So I'm kind of going on, but the equivocal area is a source of frustration, and the sliding scale of velocities. And it's not likely that we're going to have that answer in the near future because you really would have to have pathologic analysis to know what the heart is in those cases.
Right, okay. We have just about 10 minutes left of airtime. However, I did actually schedule this show to go beyond 60 minutes if we run a couple of minutes over, but I promise both of you to try to get you out of there at the top of the hour as close as possible. So I'm going to try to pick up one question. I think the next one you'll see it on your question list where there was a change in suggested dogs for use breeding purposes with the velocity changed that it says in the past you've talked about using only those dogs for breeding velocities 1.7 and below, but this person apparently recently saw that you were using the new values. And was there a particular reason for the switch?
I suspect, you know, as we try to stay current, so as time has gone on, I mean, again, 15 years ago when I finished my residency, it was less than 1.7. And after we looked at a lot of dogs, boxers, Newfoundlands, golden retrievers, and looked at the data, I think we all became more convinced that many, many normal dogs had these higher velocities up to, say, 1.9. And I think the other thing that helped is following those families. I mean, Dr. Stern had some very nice pedigrees that show if you bred a dog that was, say, 1.9, that it did not produce a lot, you know, in generations to follow. There weren't suddenly a lot of affected dogs. So I think we feel pretty comfortable moving that number up a little bit. And I think it's a mistake with a pure breed animal like the Rottweilers or any other breed that you work with to have too stringent criteria for breeding. Sometimes people think, well, the best way to get rid of this is to use very strict criteria. But if you are overly strict, you really risk narrowing your gene pool, the number of dogs available for breeding. And by selecting against something, like maybe I'm going to be really strict about what aortic velocity I use, you may accidentally be limiting your dogs to dogs that have hip dysplasia or inherited cancer,
right,
or something. So I think we have to be really careful when we use very strict guidelines for breeding that you're not removing too much of your available dog so that you're accidentally increasing the inheritance of other defects. Does that make sense?
Right. It absolutely, it certainly does. Here is a good question. Can an SAS murmur be caused by health issues other than hereditary congenital, example, aspirated fluid during birth, developed infection? Well, we did mention developed infection. Our was on medication to clear the lungs, and she was speaking basically of, you know, young puppies that ultimately had a murmur, but this puppy had health issues other than that.
Yeah, so I can take that one. So the lesion of SAS that we diagnose on echocardiogram or ultrasound of the heart is characteristic for that disease. So I don't know of any other infection or thing that happens that could lead to you having a subvalvular ridge of tissue that looks like SAS on echo. Now, there are lots of other things that can cause a heart murmur, and many heart murmurs sound just like SAS. So the heart murmur of SAS, although characteristic, is not a slam dunk for that diagnosis. So I could you have lots of other problems going on that give you a heart murmur that sounds a little like SAS? Yes. But does something that happened like aspirating fluid, I don't have anything like that in my bank of cases that would say those things cause something like SAS. Now, lots of things admittedly can go wrong in utero and as the embryos are developing, and could something that goes wrong during that time period cause SAS potentially, but the overwhelming evidence would say that SAS is familial in the Rottweiler and the Golden Retriever and lots of other breeds, and that as tempting as it is to blame it on something that doesn't go back to the breeding line, there's really not much evidence for that yet.
Right. Great. Okay, now quickly, we have indicated that bitch being in season may possibly affect the outcome of an echo, in answer to that question. Also, anxiety can cause a difference in the velocity and diagnosis. So next question, real quick as possible. I'm just really trying to stretch it here. Do all diseases present with murmurs such as cardiomyopathy? In other words, are basically SAS the only disease factor that really presents with a sound murmur?
Oh, no. So there are lots of different heart diseases that can cause a heart murmur. When we listen to dogs to screen them for congenital heart disease, we're not just trying to rule out SAS, although it's the most common that we would be listening for in the Rottweiler. We're also listening for the murmur of diseases like patent ductus arteriosus and other congenital defects that can certainly happen, although not as frequently, in the Rottweiler.
Oh, very good. Okay. Really quickly, it was hopefully just maybe a brief yes or no. Will an echo pick up congenital dilated cardiomyopathy or congestive heart failure? And if so, at what age?
Yes. Echocardiogram is good at identifying dogs that have dilated cardiomyopathy. And no, echocardiogram is not good at picking up dogs that have congestive heart failure. The diagnosis of congestive heart failure is best made on X-rays.
Okay, now into some of the hard questions here. Is it ever appropriate to breed a dog with a very low-grade murmur, like grade 1 or 2, if the breeding partner is clear and from generations back you have clear stock?
Yeah, I think this goes back to that point that Dr. Muir's made a little bit ago here, which is that being too stringent on excluding dogs from breeding can get a small breed population into a lot of trouble pretty fast. So I think if you have a dog that is the best dog in your line and it has a heart murmur, that doesn't necessarily exclude it, because remember, heart murmur itself doesn't indicate disease. So those are dogs that I would really encourage you get an echocardiogram on. If you get an echocardiogram and you realize that dog has, let's say, equivocal aortic velocities, conventional wisdom would tell most breeders that that may not be a dog that they jump to breed. However, if that dog is the end of the best line that you've ever experienced in Rottweilers and you're going to outcross it to a breed that has no recent history of congenital heart disease and doesn't relate to that dog very much, then I think that maybe that's a reasonable risk that you're assuming, and you screen it and the puppies and the generations that follow a little more rigorously.
That's great. A good answer to that, because we, you know, it's sort of like you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater in all occasions. Have in your studies, this will probably be tossed to Dr. Muir's, I know you've received a lot of pedigrees, have any of the pedigrees shown any commonalities that have begun to appear in the submissions? And of course, we're not seeking names, just does there appear to be any commonalities in these pedigrees?
I think that's a hard question. I mean, yes, one of our favorite parts to do, actually, is hook the pedigrees together, because it's a little like putting a puzzle together and trying to understand how a trait is passed on and is inherited. But I think what makes aortic stenosis very challenging is that it does appear to skip generations. And to be honest, we've had difficulty with it because it may skip a generation and then a breeder kind of loses interest in it. They think they've gotten rid of it, and so we have gaps in our pedigrees. So we've seen a few things, but not a lot.
Okay. I'm just going down the questions. I'm trying can you explain, is the Rottweiler version of SAS still looking to be a dominant with variable penetrance as suspected early on? And that's over my head, people, so I'm just going to defer totally on this one.
I think that's a really hard question. We've looked at a lot of pedigrees and done a lot of pedigree diagramming to determine the mode of inheritance for this disease. The problem is, until you have tons and tons of affected dogs and really extensive family information, determining the difference between dominant with incomplete penetrance and a recessive gene is almost impossible. So some of the work that we've done has shown families that appear to be more dominant, and some of them have shown families that appear to have a more recessive mode of inheritance. And so it's reasonable to think dominant with incomplete penetrance could be possible, but the verdict is still out on that one.
All right, one more real fast, hopefully as close to yes or no question. Is there valvular insufficiency regurgitations in relationships to SAS?
Absolutely. So both both the aortic valve and the mitral valve can be affected in dogs that have moderate to severe subvalvular aortic stenosis. So as that really high-velocity blood moves across your stenotic aortic valve, it can kind of beat it up and make it leak inappropriately. So aortic regurgitation certainly happens in dogs that have aortic stenosis. And then if you get enough pressure in your left ventricle because you have aortic stenosis, that increased pressure can then affect your mitral valve and also cause some mitral regurgitation. So, yes.
Okay, and I have one quick question off the chat, and then we're going to go in what breeders and Rottweiler owners can do to assist in the research. If this question comes in from the chat, if you're using a sire multiple times, how often should he be echoed, if more than once?
I think if you do your screening of that dog, as recommended by the Rottweiler Health Group, at 2 years of age by a cardiologist, and he's both cleared by auscultation and echocardiogram with normal velocities, that isn't a dog that needs to be reevaluated if he's clear or rated as unaffected. We don't think that this disease crops up at 4, 5, 6 years of age. So this is not one of the diseases that we think these dogs need reevaluated for.
Excellent. Okay, now let's get to what can owners and breeders do to assist you and your knowledge in research. You know, just tell us about blood draws, what kind of sample, whatever you can give, and if giving a website is, if there is a website with all of, you have the questions, I believe, in front of you, if you have a website that gives an answer to all of them, please give it.
Sure. Yeah, so on the slide set that I sent over that people can get on your website, the very last slide has both our contact information, the address for the laboratory, and a website to our new address here at North Carolina State. So much of the information on how to submit samples and participate in our research projects is available there. Briefly highlighting what we need and what could really be helpful, I'll do in just 1 second. But I first want to say a big thank you to all the Rottweiler breeders and veterinarians that have submitted samples thus far and helped with the Rottweiler research on SAS. We've collected a lot of samples, and we've made it through a very good portion of the first phase in the evaluation of this disease. That being said, we could still very much use participation of Rottweiler breeders and veterinarians that can help support us by sending us samples from dogs that either are affected with subvalvular aortic stenosis or clear of subvalvular aortic stenosis. And what we need for your dog to become a part of our research is laid out on our website there and also in that slide set. We would like to have those dogs screened by a cardiologist, by echocardiogram, and have a copy of that report. We'd like to have a 3-generation pedigree, and we'd like to have a DNA sample. And the most efficient way for us to get a good quality and quantity of DNA is if that's a blood sample. And that blood sample is best sent to us in a purple top or EDTA tube where it's not coagulated. That information is available on our website. It can be mailed in, all the papers and samples, right to our laboratory, and just mark on the envelope for Dr. Muir's or Dr. Stern research of Rottweiler SAS. We'll get it and process the sample, and you guys will be a part of helping us answer this question eventually.
Awesome. Well, I have to admit, because I by the time when I got the PowerPoint, I was so busy trying to hurry up and get it up on site to make it available that I didn't even get a chance to open it and look at it. So I will definitely go review that as well, although I'm not a breeder, but I will have that information available. One final question, then I'll let you go, and I think it's something that a lot of people would like to hear the answer. If a dog is verified with a verified echo of SAS and a sibling is normal, and we're assuming both parents would be clear, if the clear sibling is bred, what's the likelihood of SAS in the progeny, or if you even, you know, if it's or what are the percentages of affected get if one sibling is SAS, one borderline, the rest of the litter is normal, and say there's 6 in the litter?
Oh, boy. That's a really rough question. That gets back to the point that we've talked about with having the possibility for incomplete penetrance. So it is possible to have a dog that is a silent carrier or has one copy of the gene, a gene which we don't know what it is yet, carry that gene and pass it on to progeny. So in order for, you know, to make a blanket statement about what percentage of dogs will be affected is just not something we're able to do yet.
But you don't throw out the good sibling because there are there is a sibling in that litter that
You know, I think we use all of this stuff like pieces of information. So
sure.
You start yourself a little database of the dogs in your breeding program, and you give them check marks in the positive category and check marks in the negative category. And I think it's absolutely true that if your sibling has subdovular aortic stenosis, even if you're clear, that's probably a check mark in the negative category for you in the potential for breeding. But that doesn't mean that that dog shouldn't be bred, because like we talked about, you could really limit your gene pool quite quickly if you start excluding every dog that's been related to somebody with subdovular aortic stenosis. Rottweilers would become a pretty hot commodity real fast. So what we like to do is say, use that information in making informed breeding decisions and take it in light of other factors and be cognizant of checking the progeny for SAS in the future.
Excellent. I can't thank you enough on that. And there was one other really quick yes or no question, and it's gone. And that's what happens with old age. It's gone. It was in relationship to that. But both you, Dr. Stern, and Dr. Mears, I cannot express my gratitude for taking your time. And I know it's late for you, and you need to get home and take care of your dogs at home. I've kept you over. I've kept you over about 6 minutes, and I promised I wouldn't. But this has been a super informative show, and I hope I've been able to grab everyone's questions off of the chat line. Again, I can't thank you enough, and I'm receiving notes coming over chat now thanking both of you. It's been highly informative, very educational, and I think a lot of breeders are going to put this information to good use. And I just remembered that last question. I'll make it really quick. A number of people are trying to pinpoint the culprit, you might say, in the pedigrees, you know, even generations back of SAS. Is it futile to attempt to narrow the cause of SAS to a single dog or a group of dogs?
Yeah, I can answer that quickly. I think that looking back through all those pedigrees, nothing has led us to a single dog or a single family by any stretch. I can tell you the reason that we can say that this is a familial disease in the Rottweiler is because there were many, many families from many parts of the country that were not related in the slightest that had multiple dogs with SAS. So I think that taking it back to one dog, while it would make a good story and probably lots of good chatter at ringside, I don't think that that's really likely to happen.
And if I could add just a hypothetical thing on that, what if you somehow could do that, and that just happened to be what everybody thought was the best Rottweiler that had been produced
sure.
for the last 20 years? It had the best hips,
sure.
the best head, the most fabulous personality, and everybody thought that was a wonderful dog for all other reasons. And that could very, I mean, even if we could do that, that's a possibility. And so then...
Yep.
You would have to make the decision. We're going to say we're not going to breed to any dogs from that particular line, and you would be throwing out all those wonderful traits that that dog had. So I so agree with Dr. Stern. Scientifically, it's not possible, and philosophically, I don't believe it's worth spending any time on at all, because those dogs that carry the bad trait also have many, many, many fabulous traits that you will want to carefully keep in the line.
Good. I am so glad I remembered that question, because I think that is a crucial question for many, many breeders and Rottweiler owners out there, because there is always that group trying to pin, get the culprit. I'm receiving, again, additional thank yous from listeners on the chat line that they're going to partake and send in blood samples and echoes. And Teresa Carpenter indicates that they're going to miss you at the heart clearances in Washington State coming up. So with that, both of you, thank you again. Go have a dinner and get home to your dogs and give them a hug for all the rest of us. And I will talk to you next spring and to see what other good information you can share along. But I think you've done a fabulous job, and not so much in research detail, but you've got the answers to all the questions that the breeders really want to know.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for organizing it.
You bet. Thank you, and good night, both of you. And you can just go ahead and hang up, and that will clear you off.
Great. Thank you.
You bet. Good night. Okay, well, there you have it, folks. I hope you enjoyed the show. It was very informative for me. I enjoyed it tremendously. And we did have a winner. And all of a sudden my mind went blank. Anyway, we had a winner to the question, and Teresa Carpenter, she gave the correct answer of the first Rottweiler to earn an AKC championship and a CD. But did you give me the, Teresa, you're still on the chat, did you give me the name of the owner? Who owned that dog? If you did, I think I missed it because the little scroll, it's a very small, but a small screen here, and it did scroll by rather, and I'm trying to back up. Yes, you got it. I just backed up and found it. For those of you that are not on chat but still listening on the air, it was Champion Zeta's Zinda CD. It was owned and handled by Barbara Roloff, but this dog was owned by Barbara Horde. So thank you again, and I'll try to come up with another one starting next week. With that, folks, thank you so much for listening. I'm going to say good night or good afternoon in some cases to all of you. And next week we have Joe Hadle, who will be just talking about some of the old dogs that you will find in some of the older pedigrees, the dogs in Germany, and share some of the stories that he has learned about them. Again, good night. Thanks for listening. Thanks for participating. And I will talk to you next Tuesday, our regular time and place. Hug your Rottweiler. Don't forget your local Rottweiler rescue. And I can't get the music. There it goes. Okay, good night, all. Bye-bye.